chapter 7. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 this morning. Gerhard Sommer is a 97-year-old elderly man who is spending the remainder of his days living in a nursing home just outside of Hamburg, Germany. It is there where he enjoys the good things of life these last few days that he has. He receives care, he receives food, he receives treatment for the health issues that he has after having lived a very long life. Who is Gerhard Sommer, you might ask? Well, he is one of the most wanted Nazi war criminals in the world. He's been deemed unfit by German prosecutors to stand trial for all the war crimes that he has committed. What were those war crimes? Well, during World War II, he allegedly participated in the shooting, beating, and burning to death of over 550 civilians, including 119 children, all in a small Tuscan village in Italy on the day of August 12, 1944. So overwhelming is the evidence against him that prosecutors have said that if he was to ever stand trial, he would be charged for at least 342 of those murders himself. But it appears Gerhard Sommer will never stand in the courts of human earth for the trial for the crimes that he's committed. He'll never face justice here on earth for those crimes. You compare him to the true story of a godly young couple who celebrated the birth of their beautiful daughter named Elizabeth, only to discover upon her birth that she was born with Edwards syndrome. If you're not familiar with what Edwards syndrome is, it's a deadly genetic disorder that took her life just after 5 days here on the earth. A year later, that same young couple celebrated the birth of a baby boy named Joseph. And they called him Joseph because the Lord adds, they saw that as a gift to them from the Lord. They loved and they nurtured that child. What would seem like such great joy would turn to tragedy one morning shortly after Joseph turns one, when the mother and the father go into his room after a night of rest and they find him asleep or dead, having died in his sleep during the night. It doesn't seem to make sense, does it? It doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem right. You have a hardened war criminal living a long life, evading justice on this earth for the evil that he has done. You have a godly young couple desiring to serve the Lord with their lives, desiring to see their children raised up in the admonition and the nurturing of the Lord, follow the Lord, and they are left in great agony as their only children die before either of them reach the age of two. In fact, if you compare the life of Gerhard Sommer or someone like him to someone who dies young trying to live a righteous life, whether that's the two seminary students who finished seminary and decided they were going to pastor a church together, start a church together, have families, only to die together, leaving their families alone, leaving their wives alone, leaving their church alone, after having died in a car accident. You compare Sommer to the young parents, young father, the young mother who dies with children in the home, whether they've died through tragedy or whether they die through illness or even persecution. The missionary who dies trying to reach an uncivilized tribe for Christ. the men, the women, even the children at times who die because they are martyred for their faith in Christ, their refusal to back down against persecution, just even for lack of a better term, the average Christian who's just trying to live their life each day to serve the Lord and to please Him, but yet their life ends early. You compare him to any of those scenarios or something similar, and if you're honest, you're left shaking your head saying something about this doesn't add up. Something isn't quite right here. You have an evil man with a long life. You have a righteous individual with a short one. If you're left thinking about that, you're left perplexed. Why is it that way? Why does it work out that way? But that is exactly what happens at times in this life. And if we're honest about that, when we witness it, if we happen to be a part of that, we wrestle with the tension that comes in our hearts and our minds when we see that. That tension is, we know that God is all-powerful. We know that God is perfectly holy and righteous and just. We know that God is the ruler of heaven and earth. We know that God does all that He pleases. Scripture repeats that theme over and over and over again. We know that. But the perplexity is, why does He allow scenarios like those I just mentioned to happen? And more than that, why does He allow it at all? Why is there evil? Why is there suffering? Why is there death at all? How does it fit in the grand scheme of things? It is the age-old perplexity of life that not even the wisest man on earth could resolve. And that is, why does bad things, like death or days of adversity, as He mentioned in verse 14 of Ecclesiastes 7, why do bad things happen to good people, and why do good things like long life and days of joy happen to bad people? Well, I wish I could say that when we were done here this morning, you would have an answer to that question. And Solomon does not answer that question for us. But he does, and this is what is very important for us to understand, he does instruct us how to live life with this great perplexity. Because we are going to be faced with it. We are faced with it. It is thrown in our face probably almost on a daily basis. Starting in verse 15, we'll read through the end of the chapter. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 15, Solomon says, "In my vain life I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? I turned my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom in the scheme of things, and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. And I find something more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets, and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. Behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, while adding one thing to another to find the scheme of things, which my soul has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. One man among 1,000 I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. See, this alone I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes." Solomon begins here in verse 15 with the great perplexity of life. He says, there is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. He begins this really very interesting and very difficult to interpret and very difficult to fully understand passage with the perplexity that he has witnessed in his brief life again and again and again and again. The perplexity that has plagued man all the way back, if you think about it, all the way back to Abel and Cain in Genesis 4. A righteous man dying and an evil man continuing to live. And this is the perplexity. This is summed up in a world that God reigns over. Sometimes really bad things like death happen to good people. And sometimes really good things like a long life happen to evil people. While man has always wrestled with this perplexity, and sadly always will, even more so did the children of Israel, based upon their covenant relationship with God. God has specifically told the children of Israel that if they kept his commandments, life would go well with them. Life, they would live long in the land, things would go well. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 40, Moses says to them, therefore you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for all time. This was Israel's expectation. We do good, we keep the rules, we'll be safe. Nothing will happen to us. We'll live long lives. Our kids will live long lives. And then you have a scenario like that of Naboth in 1 Kings 21. Where Naboth refused to give Ahab his vineyards because out of obedience to the law of God. You have Jezebel, the wife of Ahab, who wanted the land, or Ahab was the one who wanted the land. Jezebel, his wife, sees the pity party that Ahab is going through, and she conjures up a scheme that will make sure that Naboth is falsely accused in front of the people and that he's stoned to death. And that's exactly what happens. He's stoned to death. And that would be a shock to their system. That would be a shock to their mindset. Well, wait a second, this isn't right. God has said if we keep his commandments, we'll live long. What happened to Naboth? What happened to others who died in a righteous life? How is it that this man died doing what God says? Isn't obedience exactly what God said would give us the long life? Be a shock to them. Understand, it was easy for them to establish a mindset of life that believed that as long as they just kept the rules, as long as they did everything that was supposedly right in the sight of God, they would be safe. Nothing bad would happen to them. They'd live long lives. Nothing bad would come into their lives. The same philosophy that can easily find a place amongst our own thinking about life if we're not careful. Like Israel, we can be quick to think that because we're Christians, since we belong to God, certain things shouldn't happen to us. I'm quick to think that because certain people do evil things, that certain good things shouldn't happen to them. We're the good guys, so good things should happen to us. They're the bad guys, bad things should happen to them. It shouldn't ever be backwards. Now, rarely would we verbalize such thoughts, but we can be guilty of thinking just that. When something bad or tragic comes into our life, and we're left thinking, something isn't right about this. Lord, don't you know that I serve you? Lord, don't you know that I teach? Lord, don't you know that I preach your word? Lord, don't you know that I sing for you? Lord, don't you know that I'm there every Sunday? This shouldn't happen to me. Especially when I see the coworker, especially when I see the neighbor who cares nothing about you whatsoever, and everything seems to be going great for them. Something about this, Lord, isn't right. I deserve better. We assume, because of our service at times and our commitment to God, that that should protect us. It should provide some level of protection against our lives from bad things ever happening to us. Solomon says, be careful about thinking that way. Be careful about drawing those types of conclusions because it's not always that way in life. For sure, being part of the family of God, being a child of the Lord, serving Him, keeping His word, there are blessings that come with that. Don't misunderstand me. There are blessings that come with obedience. And vice versa. There are severe consequences at times for those who live foolishly and in their evil. But it isn't always a one-for-one scenario. And sometimes bad things, even death, will happen to righteous people in life. And sometimes evil things, such as a long life, will be enjoyed by those who have no desire to please God whatsoever. This is the great perplexity of life that Israel wrestled with. It's the great perplexity that Solomon, as we'll see, he couldn't understand either. After spending all this time thinking about it, trying to figure out why it was that way, even he couldn't understand why it worked out that way. And the same perplexity that we're often faced with in life, whether directly or indirectly, whether it's something that we hear about someone else or whether it's taking place in our own life. We can't avoid this sometimes. We can't avoid this perplexity that there will be bad things that happen to good people and good things that happen to bad people. We can't avoid that at all. It's there. The question is, how do we respond to it? How does the Lord want us to handle that when it does come into our life? What is this proper response to such a perplexity? How should we respond when the bad things happen to us or to those that we know as we try to live our lives pleasing to God, or when we see good things happening to those who simply have no desire for God whatsoever? And it kind of leads us to point number two, the proper response to life's great perplexity. How do we respond to this? Verses 16 through 18. He says, "Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them." This is really a very fascinating few verses here. Because when you first read this, Solomon's words here, you might be thinking, Solomon, maybe you've been out in the sun a little too long. Maybe you've enjoyed the vineyard a little too much here. Not thinking clearly, because it almost appears that he's saying, you shouldn't really live that righteous. You know what? A little sin won't hurt you as long as you just don't give yourself completely over to that. I mean, that's a truth a lot of people would love to hear. You want one verse in the Bible that everybody would agree on, that would be it. This was, we'll see, as the context makes clear, that's not what Solomon is getting at. He tells us first here in verse 18 that we should not respond to the perplexity that good things will happen to bad people and bad things will happen to good people. We shouldn't respond to that perplexity by trying to be overly righteous. Literally, in the Hebrew, it'd be super righteous or super wise. As I mentioned, it would have been very easy for Israel, based upon their understanding of what God had told them, to develop a mindset that believed if they just lived by the rules, if we just crossed all the T's and we dotted all the I's, everything's going to be just right for us. It sounds good, but the problem was this. It led to a cold obedience. It led to a heartless obedience, a self-righteous obedience life, the same type of life that we see in the Pharisees throughout Jesus' ministry. All focusing on the external. They were like the whitewashed tombs, beautiful on the outside, beautiful externally. But inside they were full of dead men's bones. Understand, it'd be easy to develop this mindset. And here was the problem. It was a mindset in their minds that said if we just live a certain way, not only will things work out well for us, but if we live a certain way, God must bless us. God must force His will upon us in a way that is blessing to us and good to us. They felt in their minds, as long as we do what's right, God has forced upon Himself this obligation to make our lives full of happiness, joy, well-being, and a long life. And the children of Israel were tempted to think that if something had happened to someone, so that was their mindset, right? As long as we keep the rules, life's going to be good. But then you would see someone like Naboth come into the scene and say, well, wait a second, this doesn't make right because he was doing what was right, but yet this bad thing happened to him. And they were tempted to think that since something bad happened to someone living a righteous life, the problem was they just weren't righteous enough. that was the issue. Well, you know, he looked like he was righteous, but there must have been something else going on in his life. He just wasn't quite righteous enough. That's why this thing happened to him. Attempt to reason in their human lot. This has to be why something bad happened to him, is because it had to be something evil that he was doing. And it made for them, in order for them to really reason with this within their own mind, and in order for them to be able to recognize, you know, we don't want that same fate to happen to us, so in order for us to not suffer that same fate, then we have to be more righteous than that individual was. And they believed they could obtain a favor from God of righteousness, almost perfection. And they thought they could obtain a level of wisdom that would force God to bless them with life's good things. Just do enough. Just live right. That's the issue. We just got to be perfect. That will guarantee that everything good will happen to us. Much like those who, the health and wealth teachers of our day, as well as those who would hold to a very legalistic external view of Christian living. If you just do certain things, God is forced to bless you. If you just do certain things, you live certain ways, you deny certain things in this life, then life's going to be good for you. Understand the warning here. Whether we find ourselves in either of those camps, we can still be guilty of assuming that the more righteous we are, the better life that I live, the more I'm protected, the more God will be forced to bless my life and keep bad things from happening to us. And so we start trying. We try to reason in our own mind, I got to do more of this, I got to do more of that, I got to do more of this. And all these things will be good for me. Rather than trying to please God, we get in a mindset where we're doing nothing but trying to appease Him, keep His wrath coming against us. We assume that anything bad that happens is a measure of His wrath against us, His judgment against us. And Solomon says we shouldn't pursue wisdom and righteousness in that manner, thinking that we're going to obtain a level of perfection and force God to bless us. He said that's not how life always is. Sometimes bad things will happen to the most righteous people on the face of the earth, and it has nothing to do with what they did or didn't do before the Lord. And this is why he's warning them not to be overly righteous. It was a legalism. It was a self-righteous attitude that they had. We'll just obtain perfection, and that will guarantee everything will be good for us. He warns them that if they do this, this will, in essence, destroy themselves at the end of verse 16. Because their righteousness would be in vain. They would be self-righteous and legalistic. They would have a vain without knowledge. And all of those things would lead to pride and arrogance and a haughty spirit. All the things that God hates and all the things that God resists. So he says, we're not to respond to this perplexity by being merely over-righteous, as if that will protect us. Secondly, he tells us not to respond to this perplexity in life by being foolish and giving ourselves over to sin in verse 17. This is really the alternative approach to this perplexity in life. That's to think, you know what? I've tried to live righteous. It didn't work. I tried to read my Bible. I tried to study. I tried to pray. I tried to go to church. I tried to do all these righteous things. It didn't work. Bad things still happened to my life. I'm done. I'm going to give up. Why bother? That would also be the extreme response for the children of Israel. Look, Naboth was killed. He was doing what was right. The system didn't seem to work, so maybe we just abandon the system altogether. I mean, look, nothing bad's happening to them anyways. Everything seems to be good. They're doing evil, and everything seems to be happening good to them. So that seems to be the route that we should take. And Solomon says, wait a second, that's not right either. It does seem to be paying off for some people. You do have good people suffering. You do have evil people thriving. It does seem to suggest that we might be going about this all wrong. We begin to think like Asaph in Psalm 73, verses 12 through 14, where he says, behold, there are the wicked. They're always at ease, and they increase in riches. Life's good for them. Life's a piece of cake for them. They have everything this world offers. Verse 13, he says, all in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. Nothing good is happening to me. This must just be a waste of my life. I shouldn't be living this way. I shouldn't be keeping my heart clean. I shouldn't keep my hands innocent. Verse 14, for all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. He wakes up as if to say, you keep doing this wrong. Every morning he rises and realizes, there at ease, my life is one of judgment. This is all messed up. We've got to be going about this all wrong. That's how human reasoning leads us. Wisdom deceives us into thinking that while it is very true that evil people often are enjoying the best things in life, Solomon warns us here that we're not to respond that way. Because it isn't always guaranteeing either. Living righteous isn't a guarantee that nothing bad will happen to you. Neither is living completely over to evil. He says there in verse 17, why would you die before your time? And you're saying when you abandon wisdom for a life of one of evil, it could very well cost you your life as well. So that's not guaranteeing. So you don't respond to perplexity by doing right, and you not to respond to perplexity by being overly wicked, but just simply giving up and saying, I'm going to quit trying, I'm not going to do it anymore. And so if we're not to respond to the perplexity this way, by being overly righteous or being very wicked, how should we respond? Is there a wise way to handle this perplexity in life? He says, verse 18, by fearing God. He said, it is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both. Rather than abandoning both of those responses and saying, well, I won't be overly righteous, I won't be overly wicked, he says, you need to take from both of those, actually. And how do you do that? Well, you should pursue righteousness, and you should abandon evil. But the best way to do both of those without going to the extremes is to be balanced by fearing the Lord. By fearing Him, having awe before Him, having reverence before Him. You say, why is this the best response? Because the one who fears God avoids lawlessness on the one hand, and the one who fears God avoids religious arrogance before God on the other hand. And the one who stands in awe of God will seek to worship Him, trust Him, obey Him, please Him, regardless of what He brings into their life. We trust Him because of who He is. We trust Him even in the most difficult of times because God has revealed Himself to be holy and righteous and just and good and compassionate and loving and merciful. You understand, fearing God is the only proper response to this perplexity in life. You are to obey Him, to worship Him, to seek to please Him, knowing, like as he says in verse 14, there will be days of prosperity and there will be days of adversity. Understand, fearing God is the perfect balance that we need in life, that keeps us from giving ourselves over to sin and giving up and saying it's not worth it anymore. And it keeps us from saying, well, I just need to live better. I just need to be more righteous. There may be some truth that you need to make wiser decisions, but if you're simply doing it to be some type of fire insurance, there's no guarantee behind that. You say, well, why is it the right response? He tells us, number three, why fearing God is the best approach in life. Verses 19 through 29, we'll go through these quickly here. We won't read the whole passage in its entirety. But why is fearing God the best approach in life? Well, number one, it has been tested with wisdom. Look at verse 23. He says, all this I have tested by wisdom. And then verse 25, I turn my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom and the scheme of things and to know the wisdom of folly and the foolishness that is madness. Solomon tells us that fearing God is the only proper response because this is a carefully evaluated and scrutinized approach. This is not some last-ditch effort. Well, I guess if overly righteous isn't going to work, and I guess if just not giving myself over to evil isn't going to work, well, then I guess the last thing to do is just fear God. That must be what you have to do. It's not his idea at all. It's far from that, because it has been carefully evaluated. He's assessed it. He's looked at both ways. He's looked at the way of wickedness. He's looked at the way of madness. He's evaluated all these things and said, this is how you should live, by fearing God. This is the proper and only response that you have. Number two, fearing God involves wisdom, and wisdom is powerful and valuable. Verse 19, wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. And the one who seeks to please God seeks God's wisdom, and his wisdom prevails and provides us with great protection in life. Surrounded with that perplexity, and you say, what type of protection that would you need? Why would you need protection? Well, having wisdom protects you from doing foolish things, like giving up, like living self-righteously to try to obtain God's favor. But wisdom also protects you from thinking foolishly, which is what we're very tempted to do when bad things happen to us. God doesn't love me. God doesn't care. God's not responsible. He doesn't love me anymore. Why would he allow this to happen? He must just be out there floating around and not really paying attention or caring. Wisdom protects us from some of the foolish thinking that we can have, some of the foolish thinking that is developed by our human reasoning, where we're most logically left to think. Number three, fearing God avoids folly, which is entrapping. Verse 26. He says, and I find something more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. And here Solomon personifies folly as the woman who entraps her captives, probably because, like the women who entrapped him, the ones that pulled his heart away from the Lord. It's not an attack on women, because in Proverbs 9, Solomon personifies both wisdom and folly, both as women, both calling out to the simple, saying, we are here to help you. And saying, when we face difficulties, when we see good things happening to evil people, we're left to be tempted to pursue folly, thinking, well, that must be the better response in life. Everything's good happening to them. It winds up, he says, being more bitter than death. You're trying to avoid death, and so you think the best way to do that is to give yourself over to folly. And he says that actually winds up being more bitter than death itself would have been. Fearing God provides true freedom, where folly, giving yourself over to folly, as the one who would give himself to being overly wicked, would just entrap them. So the one who fears God, he says there in verse 26, escapes this trap, the one who pleases God. Number four, fearing God avoids self-righteousness, verses 20 through 22. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. Fearing God keeps us from thinking that we can obtain enough righteousness that God must bless us. You understand, it keeps us from doing the right things for the wrong reasons. We do it out of a heart that wants to please God, not out of a heart that wants some type of appeasement from him. It reminds us that we are to please God with our lives because we are sinners. It's a proper perspective. If you think that, well, I can just be overly righteous, you're undermining the very thing that happens in life. We all sin. You'll never obtain that level of righteousness that guarantees that God will always protect you, because you are a sinner. You think, well, not that much. I've done enough that obtains God's blessing to some degree, right? I don't sin that much. And he says, well, wait a second. So common is our sinfulness that it is seen just in our everyday conversations, where we don't even go a day, much less a week, saying nothing bad about someone else. You don't think you're a sinner? You can't even go without talking bad about somebody, just like they can't go without talking bad about you. You're never going to obtain enough righteousness to guarantee that your life will be always free from bad things, because you don't obtain that type of righteousness. The ability to obtain a level of righteousness where God is forced to bless us with good things as a life is impossible, because none of us live that type of life. And the fear of God keeps us from being presumptuous. The fear of God keeps us from being self-righteous. Understand, while the other two responses seem tempting, I'll just do more, I'll be better, that'll guarantee nothing bad will happen to me, or I'll just give up altogether and just live like everyone else lives. While those two may be very tempting, he says, what is the proper response is to fear the Lord? Fear Him. As we conclude, understand, life is not what we always want it to be. As he says in verse 14, there will be days of joy, there will be days of adversity. Bad things will happen to good people, and good things will happen to bad people. And I realize that I'm saying something to you that all of you already know very well. You've all probably seen it, or you've had to live through it. Let me encourage you to heed Solomon's instructions here. Don't give yourself over to being self-righteous and thinking that you do enough good that eventually God will just have to protect you from bad things for the rest of your life because of much of the good that you do. Don't give up either, thinking that it isn't worth it anymore. Instead, here he says, fear the Lord. With awe and reverence, pursue righteousness and flee evil. You thank God when good things happen, and you trust Him when the bad things happen. And as you do, you need to be settled with two things, to be resolved with two things. Number one, some things we will never know. Some things we will never understand. What Solomon says here, middle of verse 23. He said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. It was out of my grasp. I couldn't obtain it. That which has been is far off. It's deep. It's very deep. Who can find it out? In verse 27. He says, behold, this is what I found, says the preacher. While adding one thing to another to find the scheme of things, he's just saying, listen, I put all this stuff together. I was working through it. I put this piece together. And I thought, well, maybe I'll figure out why things happen the way they do. And he says there, verse 28, which my soul has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. I don't understand it. I don't know why it happens the way that it does. And he's saying some things in life we'll just never understand, and we must just live with that and trust the Lord. So be resolved that there will be some things we'll just never know and understand. And number two, maybe even more importantly, never blame God. Never blame God. You understand that all the suffering, all the evil, the sorrow, the injustice that would allow an evil man like Gerald Sumner to never face justice on this earth, it's easy to step back and say, where is God in all of this? Why isn't He doing something? Why is this allowed? Why is this happening? Why does He allow suffering? Why does He allow illness? Why does He allow sickness? Why does He allow all of those things? Why isn't God doing something about that? What Solomon says at verse 29, this is not God's fault. He said, this alone I found. Out of all my searching, all my wanting to know what's going on, how it all works out, this alone I found, that God made man upright. But they have sought out many schemes. God made man blameless. God made man upright. The beginning with Adam in the garden, which led to the fall, which led to sin and suffering and sickness and injustice and death and all the curse of sin. And ever since that, man has gone his own way. As Isaiah says, we all go astray. We all go our own way. Understand, when difficulties come, they are a result of the fall. Sin, suffering, sorrow, sickness, it's all a result of man going his own way. And you say, well, Adam did that. You would have done the same thing. So don't blame God for these perplexities in life. Instead, be thankful that God took on flesh and became the God-man Jesus Christ. Be thankful that he lived the perfectly righteous life, that he died a righteous man at a very young age, like Solomon mentions here. Why? Why did the righteous man, maybe the one man in a thousand, the righteous man, live a righteous life? So that all of us, sinful people, could have life everlasting, a long life eternally with him. You understand, it is the Lord Jesus Christ who gives hope in the middle of life's great perplexities. He is the one who gives hope and strength to the young couple who loses their children before they turn two. He is the one who provides forgiveness to an evil man like Gerhard Sommer for all the evil acts that he has done. You understand, Christ is the true wisdom that gives us peace in a world that doesn't. And so we should seek wisdom by seeking Christ. Let's pray.